The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with us on the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, we're at News Talk Science. And as ever, we get to all of those comments and texts and emails and your thoughtful ponderings in the podcast. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be speaking to Lauren Salen. Because speaking of podcasts, we spoke to Lauren about mass extinctions last year, and it was the most downloaded podcast, I think, the entire station over the year. She's brilliant, and she has this encyclopedic knowledge of what happened around the times of mass extinction. So she's going to be giving us a guided tour through the history of life on Earth, minus the dinosaurs and minus people and minus microbes too. So lots of weird and wonderful animals. It's going to be a great piece, so stay tuned for that. First though, it's time to look back at the week's science stories, and joining me via the magic of the internet are Drs. Lara Dungan and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
Black hole sun, won't you come?
Is around black holes, Shane, and you'd sort of think that these things being so massive and having such an enormous draw, we wouldn't miss them.
Yeah, but they're invisible, so it's really hard. Well, you can't see them. That, by definition, they're black, which means you have to be creative in finding them. And the most common way is looking at black holes that are sucking in gas from a nearby gas cloud. And so you're able to see the trail and you're like, where's that going? And then you follow it and it disappears and you say, oh, there's a black hole there. Alternatively, you can look for gravitational effects. So while they are invisible, they don't give off light, they do have a gravitational pull. And so you can look at the movement of stars. And if they don't follow exactly a predicted path, then you might think there's a massive object there, like a black hole, that might be causing it to deviate. And that's what's happened here. And that's, so this is the closest black hole that's ever been observed to the Earth. And they see it in the southern sky, and it's said to have been hiding in plain sight. It's around four times the mass of the sun. And in space terms, it's quite close. It's about 1,000 light years away. The Milky Way is around 10,000 light years across. So it's not too far away in terms of space distances.
It's in the borough.
Yeah, the general area, the county, if you will, you know. People have been looking at this part of the southern sky for a long time. So they see this blue star and a neighbouring star, and they thought, these are interesting by the way they were moving. And there was a scientist called Petr Hadrava who was very interested in this part of the sky and was curious as to what was going on there. And tragically, he died in 2014, and the work died with him, as he was the expert. And so this black hole lay undiscovered. That's until 2019, when we found an enormous black hole in the sky, an absolutely enormous black hole, so large that it was bigger than thought possible. And the scientists looking at that 2019 discovery realized that there was a pattern in that data that looked similar to the work that Hadrava had been interested in many years before. And so they went back and looked at his work, and they were able to discern that there was a black hole in the southern sky, the closest black hole that we've ever discovered. I think, though, what's very interesting is what we're going to do next with it, given that it's so close. And so we'd be able to, we hope, point a number of Earth's telescopes towards this near black hole and use a technique called interferometry, which allows us to effectively make an enormous telescope by combining the strength or the capacity of a number of Earth-based telescopes. It's like using them all in a synchronous way, in such a way that we can get absolutely incredible precision. And so if we do this, we reckon we'll be able to take an image of the black hole. Which you've only done once, and that black hole has been quite far away. So if we were to take an image, a photograph of a black hole, that would be only the second time ever, given how close this black hole is, we might see features or aspects of it that would be new to us.
Wow, that is exciting. Lara, our second story has to do with llamas.
It does, yeah. It has to do with llamas and the coronavirus. So everyone's two favourite topics of the moment. This is a lovely paper that came from a combination of the University of Ghent and also the University in Texas. And it's published in Cell, which is a very good journal. And it's actually peer reviewed, which is a little bit different to a lot of the papers that are coming out about the coronavirus lately. And what this is research that was originally started on SARS and MERS, which are two of the other famous coronaviruses that have caused epidemics of their own. And in 2016, they took a 9-month-old llama called Winter, and they injected him with the spike proteins, which are proteins that help these coronaviruses attach to cells. And this llama produced an immune response, like many people and animals do when they're injected with some sort of epitope like this. So what they did was they took blood from this llama and they looked at it to see if the llama had produced any antibodies. And this is all quite standard. But the really interesting thing is that llamas and camelids produce a different type of antibody than humans do. They produce antibodies that look like human ones, but they also produce a really small antibody. So human antibodies are in the shape of a Y. And these little ones that come from llamas are like one of the little arms of the Y. So these researchers took these little small antibodies and they fused them with a human antibody. And what they're hoping to do is then use these in animal studies. They've proven that even though these antibodies were developed against the virus that causes SARS, not COVID-19, they do actually neutralize the virus that causes COVID-19, which is called SARS-CoV-2. So there's a lot of different kind of confusing names in here, but they believe that these antibodies will have effect against COVID-19. And the interesting part specifically is that they might be able to use these antibodies through an inhalation system because they're so small. And because primarily COVID-19 attacks the lungs, this would be a really, really interesting way to treat the virus and to treat people who are suffering hugely from the disease. Now, again, like I said before, antibodies are transient. They don't give you permanent immunity to any virus, but they could potentially help people that are very ill, or you could give them to healthcare workers to help them fight off any symptoms of the disease or fight off the virus if it was to infect them. It's just really, really interesting basic science. And because it's been going on for 4 years, this isn't rushed. This is long, well done basic science. So we can have a good bit of faith in this paper.
Does it, because of that nature and the fact that it can work across different viruses, would it be useful if COVID mutated in some way?
So potentially, the thing with SARS and with COVID-19 is they're both caused by viruses that attach to what we think is the same epitope, ACE2. It's a little protein that's found on human cells. So there's a lot of cross-reactivity between the two. MERS is a little bit different. It attaches to a different protein in humans. But if there was any form of mutation, one of the least likely places it would mutate is in this spike protein, because it's essential for the virus to enter cells. Without this, it can't get into cells and it can't cause infections. So it's one of the least likely places for mutations to happen, and therefore the most stable and the best thing to have an antibody against.
You know a lot of stuff. I mean, I know you're a doctor in immunology, but like, I do go, wow, I don't know any of that. I mean, I really don't even know the beginnings of it. Our third story, Shane, has to do with a curious tick from a sea-dwelling mammal that has sort of puzzled researchers for some time.
Yeah, in the cutest animal story since dancing frogs or dogs that pee by aligning themselves with the magnetic direction of the earth. This story is about otters that juggle, which is fantastic. And it's done by ecologists in the University of Exeter. And they have observed otters in captivity in four zoos and wildlife parks. And they've looked at a total of 48 otters. And they've been trying to discern by doing experiments why otters juggle. They lie on their backs and they'll take up little stones and they play with them. And that's been a mystery to us. And this work has shed some light on that mystery, although I don't think it's quite solved it entirely just yet. So what they did was they looked at 12 hours of observations, which must be one of the best opportunities to do video analysis in science ever. And they looked at these 48 otters and they noticed when they were juggling and what they were doing beforehand and what they were doing afterward and who the otters were that were doing the juggling. And they saw two things. They saw that younger otters were more likely to juggle. And so they wondered if this was associated with a motor skill development. In other words, like the way children will play with their toys. And, you know, we see a very small child pick things up. They're clumsy with them. And then they learn dexterity to use their hands or their paws, in this case, properly. However, a stronger correlation was seen with otters who are hungry. And so if an otter hadn't eaten for quite a while and thus was probably hungry, they were way more likely to play with the stones. And they became more and more likely to do so as their dinner time in the zoo approached. And so the ecologists who did the study wondered, were the otters starting to get excited before getting their dinner? And so people who have dogs might notice this sometimes. You know, you go through the routine, you're starting at the dog food. The dog can sometimes do all these little dances and they're just basically excited because they're getting their dinner. And so they wonder if this behavior, this juggling behavior, is associated with otters being hungry and being excited and anticipating the feel-good factor they'll have when they get their dinner. There are, however, huge limitations to this study. It's only otters in captivity. Some of the otters had arthritis, which is very sad, but also I strangely found that quite cute. And they of course, couldn't juggle in the same way. And so other researchers in the Netherlands who are interested in this said, it's a great start. However, there are way too many variables in this study for us to say conclusively why it is that otters juggle.
Well, it sounds like someone needs to do a hell of a lot more research on this. I think maybe extending the otter watching period to 48 hours, tripling the number of otters, and really get to the bottom of this thing. What do you think, Shane?
I think so. Like, you know, there's a lot of talk from biologists at the moment about the need for research to look at vaccines and so forth. And I think that all has a place, but we need to think about putting money aside for otter studies.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Our final story, Lara, has to do with unconscious patients and a way of figuring out what's going on.
Yeah, this is actually a really interesting paper. It just got published in Nature, which most people know is a very, very prestigious journal. And it's actually a really complex and fascinating paper. But the bits that people will be able to identify with most, the concept is that they took unconscious patients and they wanted to assess what level of unconsciousness they were in. So if you divide it into an unresponsive wakefulness syndrome or minimally conscious state. So the unresponsive wakefulness syndrome is essentially a vegetative state, and minimally conscious state sort of tells you what it is in itself. And what they did was they wanted a cheap and easy way to assess which of these they could divide people into, because there are ways to assess it which are far more complex and time consuming. But what they did was they wafted the smell of either rotten fish, which was the bad smell, shampoo, which was the good smell, or an empty jar under the noses of these people. And what they found was that the people in the minimally conscious state had a much increased sniff response. So they put little nasal cannulas into their nose to assess if these people were sniffing in or not. And one of the things I found fascinating was that they also told them before they did it that they were going to waft a jar under their nose, which you think would make no difference because these people are unconscious. But actually, the minimally conscious people breathed in, even with an empty jar. So they actually, in some ways, were cognitively able to do the job that they were set out to do. And I think probably the most fascinating thing that came from it is that people in the vegetative state, there were 24 patients and 10 of them sniffed in with the rotten fish and the shampoo. So they actively sniffed in. And these 10 people were the only 10 from that group that then transitioned to a minimally conscious state. They regained more consciousness, whereas the other 14 people in the group never did, and they never sniffed in. And I just think that's fascinating. I know the numbers aren't huge, but that's 100% of the people that sniffed in became more conscious. It's not saying that this is going to be the be all and end all and it's going to be the only way to assess it, but it is an easy and cheap way to potentially assess people that are more likely to become minimally conscious. And also these people tended to survive a lot longer as well than those that didn't sniff in.
Wow, really interesting. Well, Dr. Laura Dungan and Dr. Shane Bergen, thanks very much. See you next week. Now, we think of the history of life on this planet as basically being microbes, fish, dinosaurs, and then us. But this is a huge disservice to the extraordinary diversity of life that is called the Earth home, and indeed to the work of those who study it. So we're going to take a bit of a guided tour through life, minus the dinosaurs, because they tend to hog the limelight anyway. Lauren Salen is a paleobiologist, and Martin Mayerson, assistant professor in interdisciplinary studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and she will be our guide. Welcome back to the program, Lauren.
Thank you for having me.
This is great because you were on the program, I think it was last year, and you talked about mass extinctions, and it was hugely popular. Loads of people downloaded that podcast. It was the most successful podcast of the year. So no pressure on this one. But because there's so much to talk about, I wonder if we might start by forgetting about microbes, because we've talked about the last universal common ancestor, and we've talked about early life in underwater vents and all that sort of stuff. I'd like to talk about the weird and wonderful things that happen past the microbes and well before anything that we recognize today. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's okay. Just 600 million years or so.
Well, there's lots to talk about. Great. So, yeah. So how did microbes get to animals? When did we first start to see something macroscopic in the world that we know?
So we first start to see macroscopic things show up after this time interval that's known as Snowball Earth. So Snowball Earth is this glaciation that happens about 700 to 800 million years ago, and there's different pulses before that where we think there was ice not only over the poles, but also over the equator. And it's after that melts off that we start to see things in the record coming out of places like Doshantou in China that we can actually see, that we don't need a microscope to see the microfossils, where we're not trying to get at biomarkers in the rocks, but they're actually identifiable. So some of the first things we see, one is a ball of cells, which is thought it might be an embryo, or it might be a bacterial colony. Another looks like a tiny sponge. But these things aren't determinant because those are pretty simple structures and they could be anything. But what's interesting is that the things that we can see seem to show up in multiple groups at the same time. So there's not one origin of macroscopic or multicellular life. Instead, plants do it, animals do it, fungus do it, all around the same time after this massive glaciation has ended. And then from there, the first things that we see that are really large don't seem to be related to anything that we have alive today. So this is this group called the Ediacaran fauna, which is Precambrian, so about 600 million years ago, where some things look like palm fronds and some things look like spirals, and they have these repeated patterns in chunks of their bodies. They have an actual body and a body plan rather than being one cell, and we have no idea what they do or what they are. Hmm. And then they go away, and we start to get things that we're familiar with, like arthropods, which are insects and their relatives, or vertebrates and their relatives, or mollusks and their relatives. And from then, everything's pretty normal. So it's this really rapid rise to being large, being predatory, doing something that might be recognizable after billions of years of pretty much nothing.
When you say, pretty familiar, the parts are familiar, but how they're put together is really interesting. The evolved species that we see today recombined in many different ways before they got to how they are now. And Voltaire has this great quote. He says that the best way to bore people is to tell them everything. If we take that approach to picking out the interesting or more unusual adaptations that we've seen over history, when we think about that early period, you were talking about, you know, insects and vertebrates. Is it early time when we had these enormous insects like that we just don't see today?
Yes, but that's even later than the time period I'm talking about. So back during the Cambrian explosion, which is the first time that we see these things, so about 520 million years ago, they don't look like anything that we have now. So arthropods, those relatives of insects, they're not insects. It's not like we had giant fruit flies moving around and dive bombing everything. Instead, you have these large sort of lobster-like predators that have huge compound eyes and legs sticking out of the front of their heads, which they use to grasp prey and just push them into this circular shredder that represented their mouth. And as far as vertebrates go, wow, you would think, oh, well, there's fish. There's probably salmon and tuna back there or some simple childlike drawing of a fish. Instead, the only vertebrates in those ecosystems are these sort of tiny worm-like animals that don't really have a head or something that's a little bit more structured, sort of like a leaf with segments. It's just not very promising, considering the number of vertebrates that we've had ever since, including the dinosaurs, which we're trying not to mention right now. But you just wouldn't predict going forward that we would end up with insects and land vertebrates and cows and dogs and everything else. It just looked very alien. And it's only because of all the weird stuff that happened after that that we ended up with the world as we know it. And so you do, even on land, when you get to things coming onto land, it is the arthropods that get there first. And you end up with giant, several meter long relatives of millipedes being the dominant predator, although there's some sense that they're actually detritivores, thankfully, for anything else that was around at that time, and giant dragonflies. So it is this sort of remix of all the things that we're familiar with, but in very different roles that we wouldn't expect them to have been able to do if we were looking backwards.
Sorry, when you said millipedes, you said like meters long.
Like meters long. So they're the giant millipede named Arthropleura, which was sort of the largest thing around in these early wetlands about 300 million years ago, the same wetlands that produce all of the coal that's dug out of places like Pennsylvania, places like Northern England and Scotland and other coal deposits around the world, are the remains of basically these trees that grew in place, weren't very effective at being reprocessed because there were no sort of microbes in the soil. There were no earthworms. There was nothing to turn them back into soil. So they would just sit there and decay and become coal and bury all their carbon. And then in this weird new environment, one of the main processors of that material was this giant, several meters long millipede, where we still have their footprints preserved in the actual coal itself. So we can see all the little legs moving, but they're a couple feet across.
Oh my God. So a couple of feet across and several meters long. That's, when you say giant dragonfly, how big are we talking?
So the giant dragonfly isn't quite that big, but it's still a couple feet at least. So larger than the normal bird at this period in history.
Wow. And so,
this period by now. So obviously there weren't birds back then, which is exactly how these giant insects could even live.
So when you talk about getting onto land, this is not anything to do with mammals. Mammals and the precursor to land-borne mammals, we're talking much later. So presumably this is one of those extinction events where sort of wipe the slate clean and then something else happens.
So the insect relatives got there very early. So the first land animals that we know of are things like spiders and scorpions and their relatives, which is a completely separate branch of arthropod diversity than the insects. So there's multiple invasions by arthropods. So the scorpions that show up are larger, but they look pretty similar to modern scorpions. Spiders seem to evolve on land, although they're related to things like sea spiders. And then later on, you have the precursor of insects, an animal that we don't really know what they look like or where they came from, that shows up in the aftermath of this mass extinction at the end of the Devonian period, about 360 million years ago. But what's interesting is that the precursors of land vertebrates were already around in the water before that, but it still took them a considerable amount of time to become dominant on land. And in the meantime, the arthropods had already grown to enormous sizes and were dominating those ecosystems.
Right. And so where were our ancestors at this time? We were fish or something before that?
So our ancestors at this time were, so we are a group that's known as tetrapods because we have four legs. Our ancestors first evolved these four legs in the water in basically near shore environments, sort of brackish, also floodplains near the beach, but they were completely aquatic. And the first ones that we see about 360 million years ago don't just have five fingers, they actually have between six and eight fingers. But these fingers are embedded within sort of this fleshy paddle, and they don't have any joints to speak of. They aren't really able to lift up their bodies. They are completely aquatic predators. And it seems to be only, again, a mass extinction about 360 million years ago that forces them to finally go on to land. But of course, the funny thing is that after most of them go on to land, they still breed in the water. They still lay eggs like modern frogs and salamanders. And so most of them actually just go back into the water and become predators again and lose their legs almost immediately.
Wait, what?
Yeah. So the first land vertebrates, the majority of those groups go back into the water and lose their legs and become basically eels right after they first come onto land.
Right. So, so that's an unusual development, and sort of pays tribute to this idea that evolution is not a very linear thing. It's not a it's hard to see design in some in a move like that, right? But what else? What other interesting animals are happening at this period?
So as far as other animals, right before that is sort of the traditional age of fishes. So you have very large predatory members of a group called placoderms, which are now entirely extinct, where they have these heavily armored heads. And instead of teeth, these early fishes actually use the sharpened edges of their jawbones to process prey. So it's sort of like a razor blade coming down. And that had been the dominant group up until, again, that mass extinction about 360 million years ago. Afterwards is when you see the first diversification of sharks and their relatives. But this isn't like Jaws. This isn't like the sharks we're used to. Often sharks are referred to as this primitive eating machine. They've been unchanged. They survived all these mass extinctions. But the first time that sharks diversify, they actually try to be reef fishes, which is a little bit interesting. And they try out all of these different accessories, as you might put it. So some have all of these prongs coming off of their heads, which the function of which we're not sure of. We think it may be for mating. Some of them have altered their dorsal fin into this weird bony sail that has small teeth all over it, but only the males have it. And originally the females were thought to be a different species altogether because they didn't have it. Actually, a completely different group of animals altogether until they were found sort of in the act, as it were. With the male having this modified sail and the female not having it. There are other ones that look just like angelfishes where they're flattened to the side. There are relatives of modern ratfishes, which are now only found in the deep sea, which are flattened like stingrays, but they are not stingrays. There are other ones that have fins attached to the tops of their heads. So these are the normal paired fins that are equivalent to our arms, but they're attached to the back of the neck, and we don't really know what that does either. And so sharks try out all of these different things and having sort of spiral lower jaws. Lower jaws. So Helicoprion, which is a member of this group called the Edestids, which are, again, related to ratfish. So their whole bodies look like normal sharks, we think, although we haven't found that many bodies of them. But their teeth keep growing and they grow into each other, so their entire lower jaw becomes a spiral of teeth. So in a normal shark, the teeth just fall out, so you see constant tooth replacement. We all know that sharks always replace their teeth. But what would happen if they don't fall out? They would attach to each other, and so you end up with these early relatives of sharks where they have one spiral on the bottom and then another spiral on the top, like two buzzsaws, or another one that only has the bottom spiral. And so we think these are for eating early relatives of squid that have shells, for sort of opening them up like a can, more or less. And these things are dominant, very large marine predators until they go extinct at the end Permian extinction about 250 million years ago. And then sharks really never do anything cool again, as far as I'm concerned.
Like grow teeth on their fins.
Yeah.
So sharks become uncool for the rest of history. And so where then are our mammals now, or the precursor to mammals?
So the precursor to mammals, this is another one of those counterintuitive things. So we think about the classic dinosaurs were overbearing and the mammals were underfoot, And it's only after the dinosaurs were wiped out by an asteroid that mammals got anywhere. But mammals were dominant first. So the relatives of mammals, the early reptile-like mammals, were things called therapsids or other groups where they don't have a lot of the traditional mammal features. So they were probably giving birth to live young. They didn't necessarily produce milk. They looked very reptile-like, but they had our canine teeth. That's how we can tell that they're mammals. And they were super dominant.
They had what?
So they had the same teeth as our canine teeth. So we can tell that they're mammals because they have fangs, which other groups of land vertebrates don't really have. And they have other features that unite them with mammals as well. And so about 200 million years ago, these were super dominant. Some of them even had beaks, so they had both fangs and beaks. They looked a little bit like a triceratops, but they weren't. They were early mammals. Some of them looked like saber-toothed cats, but with reptile features because they are not cats. And then, of course, the most famous one that's related to mammals that doesn't look like it is Dimetrodon, which is usually included in dinosaur toy sets because it has this giant sail on its back, but it's actually more closely related to us than it is to dinosaurs. And the precursors of dinosaurs were not really even in existence. There were a few reptiles that are actual reptiles around, but pretty much everything that you would call a reptile was actually a mammal. And then when the end Permian extinction happens, it wipes out this entire ecosystem. It wipes out all these early dog-like sort of looking reptiles. And that's when the dinosaurs come to the fore. So mammals had a chance to be dominant and sort of blew it or were unlucky in the aftermath of the mass extinction, and that's where dinosaurs come up. So mammals did become nocturnal at that point, and in fact, our terrible eyesight and the terrible eyesight of other mammals, as we all know, dogs can't see color, and that's true of most mammals, is a side effect of them being nocturnal. And as far as where actual mammals, mammals that we might be familiar with, things like cows and dogs, mammals that give live birth, mammals that have placentas, those show up in mass only after the dinosaurs get wiped out. So that part of the story is true. But there were other mammals during dinosaur times that were doing weird things. There were mammals that were gliders, which is kind of hard to fathom when you already have birds and pterosaurs, why you would have a flying mammal. There are large 3-foot-long or meter-long predatory mammals that were feeding on baby dinosaurs. There were mammals that already looked like beavers.
But,
so it's not like
mammals... So what? How did they get onto land, Lauren? Because you said there was a previous period where, you know, pre-mammals had these 8 fingers, the sort of paddle legs. They got up onto land. Yeah. They went back out. How did the getting onto land bit happen for mammals? Was that a separate event, or was it some of those paddle pre-mammals that made it up?
So the ancestor of mammals, dinosaurs, and amphibians came onto land after the Devonian extinction. So during this time of giant dragonflies and giant millipedes, at some point, some lucky early salamander-like thing came onto land. It still had been laying eggs in the water, and eventually it comes up with this great idea that rather than laying eggs in the water forever, why don't we put a hard shell around the egg? Of course, it came up with as in the one that happened to do that was the one that survived and was really successful and all their descendants took over the earth. Yeah. It's not a conscious decision. And what's interesting is that it's another one of these intervals where many groups come up with the same solution at the same time. So around the time that the ancestor of mammals and reptiles, the amniotes, is figuring out that if we put membranes around our offspring, then we can stop the water from falling out and have a pond within a shell. Trees figure out the same things, and that's the origin of seed plants, because prior to that, the trees had also had to reproduce by spores, which require water to get going. And so it's because there had been this drying out period in the sort of this time period called the Permo-Carboniferous, starting about 300 to 250 million years ago. If the waters are gone and you have no other way to reproduce, you're kind of forced to be totally on land at that point. So it's another one of these intervals, just like the glaciation, where a global environmental change triggers the same solution in a bunch of different groups and then leads to how biodiversity is from then on.
What was going on from the mammals' point of view and other animals alongside the beginning of the dinosaurs 250 million years ago?
So at the dawn of the dinosaurs, so about 250 million years ago, things were really up in the air after the end Permian. The end Permian had been such a severe extinction of life on land that everything was pretty much up for grabs. And the first opportunistic species that we see show up pretty much everywhere is this thing called Lystrosaurus. So Lystrosaurus is this pig-like early relative mammals that's still mostly like a reptile. It has a beak, it's a grazer, and herds of this thing are found pretty much everywhere. But of course, that kind of opportunism can't last very long. If you have walking meat everywhere, then you're going to have predators. And this is where sort of the first relatives of dinosaurs come from. But dinosaurs still aren't dominant for another 50 million years. Instead, what happens is their relatives, the ancestors of today's crocodiles and alligators, end up making the first strike. And so we end up with these giant predatory galloping crocodiles that have basically dinosaur-like heads doing pretty much every single job during that time period. There's also early things that look like they might be ankylosaurs, so the big armored dinosaurs, except they're not. They are also relatives of crocodiles. So these are called aetosaurs. You also have other relatives of crocodiles called phytosaurs, which look pretty much the same as Lystrosaurus, except that they are reptiles and not mammals. So they've come up with the same beak and the same grazing and everything else.
Wow.
And then that gets all swept away by yet another mass extinction 200 million years ago. That finally allows these marginal sort of bipedal things to become the dinosaurs that we know of, to replace these extinct crocodiles that pretty much get wiped out at that point.
And so what sort of unusual mammals are we seeing 200, 150 million years ago?
So the unusual mammals that we see, so normally in conceptions, we think of mammals as being underfoot at that point, being little rat-like creatures cowering under the dinosaurs. But recent discoveries have shown that this is not really the case. Mammals are diversifying during this time. This is when we think marsupials first show up, when monotremes like platypus first show up. And in fact, platypus have pretty much existed in some form or another since about 150 million years ago. And that includes their beaver tail and their sort of sensory duckbill, that there's some form of that. We also see other early mammals that look something like modern beavers. We have other early mammals that are giant, that are predatory, that are hunting, that are cat-sized or dog-sized. So they're not really underfoot. And part of the reason for this may be that for dinosaurs, you don't see adult dinosaurs that are smaller than a certain size. So there still is opportunity for other groups, even though the dinosaurs exist. And we also see this kind of weirdness in the crocodiles at the time, that even though we don't have the large sort of predatory galloping crocodiles necessarily, there are crocodiles that have their own pig faces. There are crocodiles that are doing different jobs. There are crocodiles that are eating dinosaurs regularly, just doing all sorts of sort of mammal-like things that we wouldn't expect at that same time.
And what about the fingers? Where are the fingers in terms of development at this stage? Are these creatures, do they have anything close to a hoof? Is it claws? Is it is it webbed feet, or what do the mammals' hands look like?
So most of them at this time have five fingers, which seems to be the limit ever since about 360 million years ago. So for various developmental reasons, ever since that end Devonian extinction, the maximum number of fingers that anything has is five. Now, there are exceptions to this. So it turns out that the thumb, our thumb, for whatever reason, is now genetically programmed to be a thumb. And if you wipe out those genes, you can get multiple fingers again. It's just that nothing has really done it.
You're saying if we knocked out one of our genes, we could have a bunch more fingers on our hand?
Yeah, so in experiments in embryos of, say, mice, there are genes that control our thumb, which is why it looks different than other fingers. So genes for thumbness. And if you wipe those out, you end up getting a lot more fingers in that spot than you would normally expect for any animal in the last 360 million years. So you can get more than five.
Wow.
So that's the main limitation, but it's really strong within basically all vertebrates since then. So vertebrates have lost their digits. And we can see this in, for example, horses, that we know that there was digit loss down to one, or even in dinosaurs and birds where they've lost digits and they just have three left. But the maximum seems to be five because of those genes.
Okay. So where next?
So the next thing that happens, of course, is mass extinction at 65 million years ago when an asteroid hits the Earth. So that's the leading theory at this point. It goes back and forth in terms of debate about what actually happened. But we know the asteroid, that an asteroid hit. So we know that it was probably a day in June or July because we have the pollen that was around at that time. Flowering plants had just evolved. So I think this is something that most people don't realize, is that we think of plants as being naturally older than everything else. But plants, of course, have their own evolution and their own succession of different groups, where early on you have things that are producing spores that are related to modern ferns. Those become trees. Trees have evolved a number of different times in a number of different groups. So there's not just like one tree. And the trees that we have now are actually the most recent resurrection of that really successful body plan. But earlier trees were related to, say, ginkgos or cycads, which are now just living fossils where there's just one species or a few species. And flowering plants, flowers, don't show up until about 150 million years ago. And there's debate about even this time and what the earliest evidence is.
Wow.
So in all the animals that we've been talking about, all the swamps, people probably think they can imagine it in their heads as being modern swamps and there being fruits or nuts or berries. None of that existed. You have to have flowers to make those things. So when we're talking about herbivores earlier on, they are just eating basically the equivalent of pine needles and ferns. And these things take a long time to grow back. There's also no grass on the face of the earth. Grass only showed up in the last sort of 40 million years. And it only became dominant very recently.
Wow.
Imagine you have large herbivores, much larger than we have today, even these large herbivorous dinosaurs. And what are they eating? They're eating sticks and pine needles and cycads and ginkgo leaves, if they're lucky.
So the extinction of the dinosaurs is gone. Presumably at this stage, everything that's remaining is very familiar to, there is a version of it here today, apart from maybe size.
Yeah, so there's versions, but they are not related versions. So mammals themselves have come up with the same ecologies multiple times just since the dinosaurs died. So we see, of course, this diversification of mammals following the death of the dinosaurs. But a lot of the early predators, things that we might think of as being hyenas or dogs, they are not related to modern hyenas or dogs. The modern carnivores that we have also only show up about 34 million years ago. So for the first half of the age of mammals, it's dominated by groups that today either look very different or don't exist any longer. And so a lot of the large predators that we see early on, things like this one predator called Andrewsarchus, which was once thought to be related to whales, they're actually members of the same family as hoofed mammals, as deer and pigs, and everything that we might think of as being herbivorous. But early on, they were predatory. They had giant teeth. They looked like sort of dogs with long tails. And some of them even returned to the ocean to become the modern whales. And you wouldn't have expected that looking at them either. And so we have this early diversification of mammals that results in all of these weird mammals that we don't have anymore today. So we get sort of the largest land mammal that ever existed, this sort of long-necked rhinoceros that shows up about halfway through. We get sort of predatory pigs, sort of pigs from hell that still have multiple toes that are the top predators during that time period. And these things just don't exist anymore.
And we had much larger versions of a lot of the animals that we know today, the auroch being this enormous cow, four times the size of a typical cow today. We had the mammoth. Were there any megafauna that would surprise listeners to know that existed, and enormous animals that we may not have heard of?
Yeah, so besides the ones that we're familiar with from recently, so we do get other sort of large mammals, not just large mammals, but large birds as well. So just because the dinosaurs had been wiped out doesn't mean that their relatives, the birds, couldn't take over. So until relatively recently, we had these giant predatory ground-dwelling flightless birds that we think were going after
penguins or ostriches or what?
So they're called terror birds because they basically have a giant eagle beak and they're predators, and they're about 6 feet tall. And they lasted in South America until relatively recently. And some of the modern birds that are related to these things, you would never be able to tell that they had been anything like this. They look totally different. And even as far as penguins, you know, we are used to the emperor penguin being pretty large, but there have been larger penguins in the past. There have been penguins that were much taller than them. So you basically human-sized penguins hang out in Antarctica before there was ice. So we associate penguins and ice too, but the penguins were in Antarctica before Antarctica froze over. So they've more or less adapted to the conditions that they had to deal with rather than being a result of those conditions.
Right. Any others of note before we get to modern times and finish our journey?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a whole lot of weird mammals. There are sort of horned relatives of gophers that show up pretty early on where they have a horn coming out of the top of their head. Again, only the males and relatively large. There have been really giant beavers in the past. So bigger versions of the things that we're familiar with, just as you might expect out of some movie of prehistoric life. But then you have other ones where they have sort of one single horn coming from the top of their head. So like an actual, a relative modern antelope that's sort of like a unicorn because it has that single prong coming off of the forehead. Maybe they found early fossils of it. Also, you look at things like modern armadillos where they're relatively small. And then if you go further back in time, you find giant armadillos that look something like a blown up cannonball with just a head sticking out of one end that are now entirely extinct. And of course, it's the same thing with the giant sloths. And so modern sloths are slow. There used to be giant ground sloths that had big claws, and it's thought that they might have been predatory as well. So mammals over time tend to get larger over the last 65 million years just through competition with each other. So this is something that's been known as Cope's rule and has been observed for a long time in the fossil record. But the loss of these things recently is not necessarily natural. And so that's where we get to when do humans start to determine what lives and what dies. And, you know, another thing illustrating about how we assume that everything we're familiar with goes backwards is it's not just grasses that show up relatively late. Rodents also turn up relatively late. So rodents have sort of taken over the entire world in the last tens of millions of years. So they replaced a lot of earlier relatives of, say, primates or other insectivores or other shrews or things that we might not be as familiar with today. So whereas rodents, we think of them as being very primitive because, again, they're that small underfoot thing that was probably around when the dinosaurs were around. They've actually developed these teeth that grow forever. And when they first originated in South America, most likely several millions of years ago, they were a lot larger. So today, the largest rodent that we're familiar with is sort of a capybara or something like that.
Big
there were
rodent.
Even larger herbivorous rodents in the past.
How and big?
So the size of, say, a small horse or something like that.
Wow.
So it used to be that South America was an island, sort of like Australia is now. And so because it was an island, because it was isolated, it had a lot of weird things that occurred on it. So the terror birds occurred there very late. It had things like giant ground sloths, but also these giant rodents. It had groups of sort of what we might call hoofed mammals, where it wasn't clear what group they were actually related to until relatively recently. So they look for all the world like they're hoofed mammals, but they're an entirely separate lineage that's evolved some weird shapes and weird prongs and antlers and everything that was thriving down there. Unfortunately for these things, once South America joined up with North America, they basically all got wiped out, including an entire thriving marsupial fauna, much like what we see on Australia today.
How good are the fossil records of these animals that you're talking about?
So the fossil record in general is really good for these things. especially as you get more towards the recent, you find a lot of pieces, a lot of articulated bits. The mammal fossil record isn't as good. It's mostly teeth, especially early on when they do tend to be smaller. So if you go back into dinosaur times, for example, you find mostly teeth because it's the hardest tissue in their bodies, whereas the rest of the mammal skeleton isn't as robust until they get really large. But as you get towards the recent, you find more and more material. You find really well-preserved material. And even going back to those earlier groups that are they're now completely extinct, the earlier groups of mammals from about 50 million years ago, we get these good snapshots. So there's this pit in Germany called Mesel Pit from about 50 million years ago or so, where the preservation is so good in that setting that it shows us features like fur and the internal organs and the actual iridescence of the early insects that are found there. We can reconstruct the entire ecosystem from its base, from the plants, all the way up to the largest predators. And so sometimes the fossil record, we get snapshots like that where we can suddenly see everything.
But and we can just taking one example, the predatory deer dogs that returned to the water to become whales. How sure are we that that happened, and how do we know what they look like?
So we're sure that that happened because of a number of discoveries that have come out of the area around Pakistan and India, which is about the same time period as Mesel Pit.
Right.
So mammals actually came into the water and turned into whales relatively early on after the extinction of dinosaurs. This is only about 10 million years out, replacing things that had been lost, like large fishes or the marine reptiles that had come before. And so we've been able to build a full sort of transformation series from these early relatives of deer, which look for all the world like sort of today's swimming deer, or sort of like a combination between an early carnivore and a deer, in that they have the specialized ankle bone that all deer and all hoofed mammals with an even number of toes have, which is what tells us that it's related, all the way through something that looks like an otter to something that looks like a seal to something that looks like an early whale but still has four flippers instead of just two, to something that looks like a modern whale. Although the whales that we have today, like a lot of other things that I've mentioned so far, only start to show up about 34 million years ago, we have the onset of the most recent ice age, and we have a change in the global ecosystem, in the global climate. Things get drier, which leads to all of the mammals sort of having to take on new roles, and they either go extinct or diversify. So by that I mean is that the whales that we're familiar with, things like humpback whales or baleen whales, show up at that point, taking advantage of a lot of new plankton that's in the system. Prior to that, whales were a lot toothier, a lot more predatory, even though that they were at large sizes. So much larger than a modern orca, for example, and much more predatory. And you even had things like early sperm whales where they had teeth both on the top and the bottom of their jaw.
Wow. It's so weird to think of these transitions happening, and it's amazing to speak to you about it all. I've really enjoyed our little journey, and I know there's so much more we could have covered, but Lauren Sallon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I don't know about you, but I absolutely loved that. And if you'd like to see some of the pictures of the animals that Lauren was describing, you can check them out on our Twitter page. It's twitter.com/newstalkscience. Producer Aidan McKelvey joins me on the program, sort of heavily panting. Are you okay?
I'm okay. You caught me mid-workout. But I was just doing my least favorite exercise. Oh, the reps are unbelievable. Unbelievable reps.
I know nothing about working out. So what, you're lifting heavy things, is it?
Basically, yeah. Doing kind of planks and heavy things, holding my legs up for a certain amount of time. It's really, really not exciting.
That sounds like yoga.
It's sort of a bit between Pilates and weights. I have some weights as well. But it's the least exciting exercise I've ever done. I'd rather be playing a sport or something.
Yeah, but you can't get that upper definition on your torso that you crave from that sort of exercise. So
no, that's true. I'm not just you don't just exercise for aesthetic reasons, you know, John.
Okay, sure. No, why wouldn't you cycle or go for a run then? I don't get that.
I would love to be doing that, but I have many reoccurring injuries from my days playing football. And for some reason, every time I go for a run, my back or my calves give in. It must be something to do with the repetitive motion. Like, I can play a game of football for 2 hours, but if I go for a jog after 5 kilometers, something's got to break. Oh. I don't know why that is.
Okay. Okay. You should see someone about that, I guess. Okay. Yeah. So on the show last week, we were talking about, and I was hoping I wouldn't have to say this again because it's a real mouthful, but we were talking about eosinophilic esophagitis. Andre Boyce said, it's so frustrating. Cheap bread, deli chicken, chicken breast, sausage sandwich, diagnosed with it about 10 years ago. Nobody knew what it was except for the consultant. Yes, yeah, so they have a really restricted diet in this, I can imagine. I'm wondering, like, is there a condition that is the most restrictive in terms of what you can eat? Is there something that says you can just eat these two things? But it sounds awful. And Eileen's gotten in touch. She says, EOE sounds like an illness my brother has, which was diagnosed as achalasia, but with little help via treatment. It might be worth just asking your doctor, had they considered EOE? I mean, I have no idea. I wouldn't diagnose via the radio, but certainly if that sounds like a good fit and there isn't improvement with your current treatment, maybe, you know, you might ask your brother to speak to his doctor and say, what's the story? We also spoke about anechoic chambers. We were speaking to Steve Orfield, president of Orfield Laboratories in the States. And Elaine says, the engineering department at TU Dublin Tala have an anechoic chamber. When we reopen, Jonathan's welcome to visit. Yes, that sounds fine.
Why was it Jonathan only? Can I come?
No. That's amazing. So I didn't know that. So that we can go inside an anechoic chamber. Should we do it like and see how long it can last? Would that be a good thing to do, Aidan?
Or, yeah, I think that would be a good experiment. Or see if you start about, hallucinating.
Were we worried about what will come out? Like, could it be, you know, could it, as it is, I always feel like I'm just in danger of spilling over. I'm just wondering if I'm put in under that sort of pressure of just hearing my own thoughts and my body for 45 minutes, could I crack? Could I come out with an axe, is what I'm saying.
Well, it's part of my production remit to take you as close to that line as possible. That's where we get the radio gold. So exactly. I'm all up for it.
Is the blood rushing to his face? Is he gnashing or foaming at the mouth? If not, do it again.
No, none of Jonathan's dangers is too dangerous for us at Future Proof, says me.
Exactly. As long as there's a chance of getting him back from flatline, screw it. And then we're talking about COVID-19. John Clondalkin says, Jonathan, what was the origin of the coronavirus, as it's now thought by some that it came from a lab in Wuhan? No, John, it's thought by a very small member of the world to be from a lab. I think there's pretty convincing evidence it did not come from a lab, and that it came from the wild, possibly a wet market, but it's not engineered, as far as I could see. All the reputable sources seem to say that, and the people who benefit from saying it seem to be the only ones who are saying that it's coming from a lab.
That's the key thing. Yeah. It's funny who says that. It just happens to coincide with all the people for whom that would be beneficial.
Someone else says, keep Dublin and Cork locked down. They've got the most cases. Loosen restrictions for the rest of the country. Obviously, if you loosen restrictions, then Dublin and Cork may not have the most cases. But it does seem to me odd that someone living in an apartment in the city centre would have the same restrictions put on him or her than a farmer living 6 miles from the next town. But I presume those 2 km limits probably weren't observed massively in the middle of the country. I would say reasonably enough. Do you hear anything about that, Aidan?
Yeah, I haven't heard much about it, but I have heard they have said in a couple of the press conferences that they will look at that. Like that. Yeah. I think they're just afraid to say it because it's Ireland, so we don't really obey strict laws. It's just a don't take the piss rule. So
yeah,
people are like, hey, that's grand. I can do whatever I want now.
Yeah,
I think they will. They might lose them in down the country quicker than they do here.
This is the problem. Dublin. If you are vague, you're leaving too much open to interpretation. So you have to go for lowest common denominator when it comes to restrictions, which seems outrageous to some, but very relevant and pressing for others. So look, if you could manage it that everyone would just do what they were told in terms of social distancing and interacting with others, you could probably open the country again. But the fact is that people aren't, even when the strictest of measures are in place, people aren't observing those very well. If you loosen it up, we're just likely to see more of the same. So I think it's the best advice is clear advice. And I think people wondering what they can or can't do will only lead to people thinking, I'm probably okay to do this. And if the guards stop me, I'll say, but it's not very clear. So I think it is the way it is for a good reason. Right. I think that's it. We are still looking for your questions. So if you have an unanswerable question or a weird question, something you think we might answer or even giggle at, please email them into us, science@newstalk.com. We have a very special episode. We're calling it Faster Proof, and it's coming up in a couple of weeks, in which we try and answer as many of these questions as possible during the program. So email us in, science@newstalk.com. But for now, thanks to Aidan McKelvey, producer, Simon Keane, researching, and on sound, Peter Malloy. We'll be back with more Future Proof in the podcast feed. If you liked today's episode, Lauren Salen will be talking specifically about mass extinctions on Thursday in Future Proof Gold. We'll be back with more Future Proof on Saturday. In the meantime, stay curious.